Good evening. Another candidate drops out of the Democratic presidential race, and a NYPD cop resigns. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo for the WBAI News for Thursday, January 2nd, 2020. Democratic presidential candidate Julian Castro said he was dropping out of the race with a heavy heart. The only Latino in the race, Castro is the former secretary of the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Department and mayor of San Antonio. His campaign released a video with the candidate's farewell message.
Me llamo Julian Castro. I am a candidate for president of the United States of America. The very fact that I can say that tonight shows the progress that we have made in this country. Like many of you, I know the promise of America. My grandmother came here when she was 7 years old as an immigrant from Mexico. And just two generations later, one of her grandsons is serving in the United States Congress, and the other one is running for president of the United States. We've been a little bit different from all the other campaigns. We've been speaking up for the most vulnerable folks in this country. People sleeping on the streets.
That image of Oscar and his daughter Valeria is heartbreaking. It should also piss us all off. My plan also includes getting rid of Section 1325 of the Immigration and Nationality Act to go back to the way we used to treat this when somebody comes across the border, not to criminalize desperation.
This president is caging kids on the border and effectively letting ISIS prisoners run free.
If police in Charleston can arrest Dylan Roof after he murdered 9 people worshiping at Bible study without hurting him, then don't tell me that Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and Ayanna Jones, what about Eric Garner and Laquan McDonald
and Sandra Bland and Pamela Turner?
What about Stephon Clark? And what about Antonio Arce? What about all of those young men and women whose lives were lost because of police violence? They deserve justice too. No matter who you are, no matter what you look like, no matter the color of your skin, you ought to be treated the same under our justice system. And we can help bring that about. I'm the only candidate that has put forward a plan on police reform. I haven't been afraid to stand up and speak the truth and fight for people that often aren't fought for and speak up for people that are often forgotten. If we all work together, we can build a nation more prosperous, not only for those who are already doing well, but for everybody else.
I'm going to tell the truth. It's time for the Democratic Party to change the way that we do our presidential nominating process.
And Castro was an advocate for immigration reform. He qualified for the first 4 debates, and although he met donor thresholds set by the Democratic National Committee, he failed to reach polling requirements in order to make the last 2 debate stages. Meanwhile, Democratic presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders on Thursday snagged the endorsement of a high-ranking New York City official, public advocate Jumaane Williams.
To have someone like Bernie Sanders in office after we get rid of number 45, because we have to have someone in there who's not just going to heal and unite, but is dramatically going to change the systems that are in place. When I first got elected, I made the decision that I didn't get elected to get reelected. I got elected to try to cause transformational change for people who feel their voice hasn't been heard, to make sure that everybody can benefit in our society. I think Bernie has done the same thing. I honestly believe that's the reason he got involved. Way back when he was just a student activist, like I was, to now, he has not wavered from the messages he's been pushing. If we're going to climb out of this darkness, if we're going to push back against the president in this White House, who enables the type of division that we're seeing right now, who is enabling the system where very few can benefit because they get to continue these lies and say, hey, look at that person over there. You're not benefiting because of them. That's the wrong message. Bernie has a message saying we can all benefit. His message resonates because everybody understands that they have a right and a claim to be American, to breathe this air as everybody else does, to say, I too deserve quality housing, quality health care, quality education. We all deserve that. And they look up and they say, well, why is it only some people who get it? And Bernie is saying, that's not right. And I'm going to help lead a charge to make sure we reverse that. We have to have the courage to push Bernie forward.
And Sanders welcomed Williams' endorsement in a tweet last October. And last October, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, also a candidate for president, had endorsed Williams' race for public advocate. On New Year's Eve, Warren spoke to supporters at the Old South Meeting House. She reiterated her support for single-payer health plan for the United States.
If you are a typical American household, your family spent almost $12,000 last year on health care. About one in five of you, including people with insurance, didn't fill a prescription because you couldn't afford it. So now, imagine an America where Medicare for All ensures health care is a basic human right. Imagine an America where you could get your prescriptions filled without having to worry about the cost. Imagine an America where black maternal health is a priority. Imagine an America where, if you get really sick, you can concentrate on getting well and not worry about bankruptcy. Imagine an America where monthly Social Security checks are big enough to cover the bills and leave a little extra for home repairs or an occasional meal out or maybe even birthday presents for the grandchildren. While the survival of every living thing on this planet hangs in the balance, while fossil fuel companies still call the shots in Washington, imagine an America that has come together to beat back the climate crisis and embrace a Green New Deal. And imagine what's possible.
And in more election news, Nevada Democrats won't caucus for Michael Bloomberg next month. The former New York City mayor and Democratic presidential candidate did not file with the Nevada State Democratic Party by a January 1st deadline. Bloomberg is intending to bypass the four early voting states, including Nevada, which will be third to express a preference on the Democratic presidential field. Instead, he has his hopes hinged on the other states, including California, where a large number of delegates are up for grabs. California is among more than a dozen states that vote on March 3rd, known as Super Tuesday. The party's seventh debate is set for January 14th. And in international news, by the way, you're listening to WBAI News. I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York. In international news, Hong Kong police arrested about 400 people on New Year's Day in New Year's Day protests after what started as peaceful pro-democracy march of tens of thousands and spiraled into chaotic scenes with police firing tear gas to disperse the crowds. And United States Defense Secretary Mark Esper said on Thursday there were indications Iran or forces it backs may be planning additional attacks, warning that the game has changed and it was possible the United States might have to take preemptive action to protect American lives. And the U.S. State Department on Thursday imposed sanctions on Cuba's defense minister for alleged human rights violations and his support of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, barring him and his children from entering the United States. And U.S. President Donald Trump and his Turkish counterpart, Tayyip Erdogan, agreed on the need to de-escalate tensions in Idlib, Syria. The White House said on Thursday, a day after eight people were killed in a Syrian missile strike in the province. But that did not stop the Turkish parliament from approving a bill that allows troops to be deployed in Libya, paving the way for further military cooperation between Ankara and Tripoli. Fayez al-Sarraj's internationally recognized Government of National Accord, formed after United States forces overthrew the government of Muammar Gaddafi, has been trying to fend off rebel soldiers. The rebels are led by General Khalifa Haftar, a former associate of Gaddafi, and are backed by Russia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan. Later on Thursday, Erdogan discussed Libya with U.S. President Donald Trump in a phone call, the Turkish president said, without providing more details. Erdogan is due to discuss Libya with Russian President Vladimir Putin later this month. Associate Professor of Peace and Conflict Studies at Colgate University is Jacob Mundy. He says behind the fighting are new discoveries of oil and gas resources in Libya.
Earlier this spring, there's been an offensive by one of the larger coalitions of militias. They call themselves the Libyan National Army, and they're led by Khalifa Haftar. He's been trying to consolidate his total grip on Libya through a siege of the capital, Tripoli, the city where a vast majority of Libyans actually live. And this has been going on for several months, and Haftar has been supported by outside states such as Egypt, the UAE, apparently even Russian mercenaries are on the ground. At this point, the internationally recognized Government of National Accord appealed for help from Turkish authorities, which they share some ideological alignments with. And Turkey has said that they will assist. And the parliament today in Turkey voted to authorize the dispatching of troops, but apparently none have left yet.
The government that's in Tripoli that's under assault, who do they represent and who's backing them?
The government is headed by a presidency council whose chair and the nominal head of state is Fayez Sarraj. The Government of National Accord actually incorporates three different bodies which share different alignments. So even the what it's often called the internationally recognized government is itself very fractured. What people tend to be talking about is this presidency council, which was established following a peace agreement in 2015 that established a new supposedly unity government in Tripoli. But this body has really never had legitimacy. It hasn't been able to deal with the militia problem, which is what Haftar claims he is doing, that Haftar has basically gained control over most of the country and has installed a certain degree of order, albeit an authoritarian order. So Haftar's last push now is to get into Tripoli, where some of the strongest militias remain. One could easily say it's the militias that run Tripoli, not Fayez Sarraj and the presidency council.
Where does the U.S. stand on this? Where does the Trump administration stand?
Unsurprisingly, the U.S. has gone back and forth a little bit. There were some indications earlier in the spring that Trump might be throwing his weight behind Haftar, which might make sense given Egyptian, Saudi, and other Emirati support for Haftar. But it's been U.S. policy to support the peace process and the Government of National Accord, especially Fayez Sarraj. And it's very clear that Haftar's move into Tripoli wasn't just this sort of mission to cleanse the city of militias, but was about disrupting the UN peace process, which was trending in a direction that might not have been very favorable to Haftar's position.
Haftar used to work with Gaddafi.
Not only part of Gaddafi's coup in 1969, but he eventually turned against Gaddafi when Gaddafi failed to really support him and his he was leading the war against Chad in the 1980s. It appears that Haftar was a CIA agent for many years as he lived in exile in the United States. Haftar returned in the 2011 revolution, but was sidelined for a couple of years and then returned to prominence in 2014 when a new civil war erupted.
We saw a situation in Baghdad the other day where militia fighters took over the U.S. embassy, which was in itself shades of what happened in Tehran back in 1979. And then we have the famous emails relating to Benghazi, as they are talked about in American politics. So does any of this have anything to do with what's happening on the ground in Libya?
Events escalating in Libya have been going on for several weeks now. One of the triggers is actually that the Sarraj and the Presidency Council signed an agreement over territorial rights in the Mediterranean, where there's a big scramble for gas and oil going on right now. And Egypt is not happy about that at all. Neither are Greece and Cyprus and other countries. Right. So the real trigger here might be an energy conflict.
It's not the fevered imagination of President Donald Trump seeing conspiracies behind every door.
No, but the conspiracy might be different than the ones he thinks.
Jacob Mundy is Associate Professor of Peace and Conflict Studies at Colgate University. Closer to home, Democratic congressional members from New York are lauding the recent passage of increased funding to help improve security at houses of worship. Nine Democratic U.S. representatives appeared at a press conference on Thursday at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. Grant workshops will be held throughout New York City area in the coming months to help high-risk nonprofit institutions learn about the program and apply for funding. Representative Elliot Engel had this to say.
I remember as a little boy growing up in the Bronx, and I was learning about the Holocaust, I thought, it couldn't happen here, could it? Couldn't happen here. You know what? It could happen here. And it could happen here if people of goodwill say nothing. It could happen here if people excuse it and say, well, you know, these people are mentally ill, and therefore you've got to kind of, you know, cut them a little slack. Absolutely not. People have a right to go in their homes. This was in somebody's home. People have a right to feel safe in their homes. People have a right to feel safe in their community. And I just want to pledge that we in the New York delegation, we're a tight-knit group, and we're going to continue to work together until the scourge of anti-Semitism and anti-anything is put to rest.
And Representative Gregory Meeks.
I wish I wasn't here today. Because I wish that the symptoms of cancer that is taking place in our country didn't exist. I wish that we didn't have this sickness in our society. I had thought that when you look at this great experiment that we call America, that we have observed from our past, that we would do better, and that we would have been healed by now from the sickness of hate. That we would have learned by now that in this place that we call the United States of America, and in this city that is a and has been an example of multiculturals and multi-religions, and of acceptance would not become part of the cancer that's now existing in our country. And it means that we've got to all come together to make sure that we do everything, leave no stone unturned, to get rid of this cancer that is eating at our society.
And that's Representative Gregory Meeks. And the white off-duty NYPD cop who was busted in Nashville last September after he barged into a black woman's home in a drunken stupor and threatened her and her kids with racial slurs has resigned. His name was Officer Reynolds. I'm sorry, I don't have his first name here. But Officer Reynolds, who's 26 in September, pled no contest to assault and trespassing charges. The NYPD was about to begin a departmental disciplinary action against him. He will not get his pension or health benefits. He also cannot carry a gun. At a rally outside of One Police Plaza before Reynolds resigned, New York City activists led by Reverend Kirsten Foy of Arc of Justice demanded Reynolds be fired.
He broke into their home while they were in bed, threatened them, held them captive in their own home.
This happened to people in Tennessee, but we here in New York are standing for and with them. We demand that there be justice here, that there be justice in Tennessee.
And Reverend Foy spoke with WBAI this afternoon. He says the officer's resignation is a very small step towards justice.
We've taken an additional step towards justice. But remember, he was charged with misdemeanor crimes for what amounted, in my estimation, to very serious felonies. He broke into a family's home, brandished his weapon. For all intent and purposes, he held them hostage in their bedroom, despite dogs barking at him and charging at him. Despite cameras surrounding the area, despite a 911 call, despite the fact that two of his fellow NYPD officers were with him, although they may have not entered the home, there were enough checks on this man's behavior that what he was charged with was severely deficient. In our estimation, he should have been charged with domestic terrorism. He should have been charged with biased crimes for using racial epithets and threatening this family with his weapon. So this was a step in the right direction. But there were also two officers with him that both enabled him as well as tried to obstruct justice by telling the family that they were police officers and they had immunity, so there was really nothing for them to complain about.
Shades of Eric Garner there, in the sense of there were other officers present and they were never punished or brought up on any sort of charges, as far as I know.
That's right, which brings us back to our core point that there is an issue with the culture that really has not been dealt with all of the reforms that have been enacted and the trainings and all of the attempt at transforming the department. We have not really seen a change in the culture. So when you have a bad apple, you tend to have other officers around that bad apple that either enable them and or protect them. And that blue wall is really what needs to be torn down.
Yeah, and wasn't this a law he broke? This is in Tennessee, in another state. So didn't he break the law? Wasn't he brought up the charges in Tennessee? Didn't they undercharge him, as you've intimated?
Absolutely.
And what is that? So does New York really have anything to do with that?
Well, it does, because we employed him. The gun that he used in the crime was an NYPD-issued weapon. So look, he was there. He acknowledged he was a police officer when he was approached by Nashville police officers. He identified himself as an NYPD officer. The people around him identified themselves as officers. So they really misrepresented their authority and misrepresented and abused their power as New York City police officers. And so that is a violation of not just the patrol guide, but it's a violation of basic civil service, the civil service oath and other training and policies that have been in place for years. They just dismissed all of that and decided that they were going to abuse their authority. And so the NYPD has an obligation under those circumstances to take action against these officers. If not criminal action, certainly administrative action can be taken, not just against Michael Reynolds, but against the other two yet-to-be-identified officers that both enabled and then tried to engage in obstruction of justice. When intimidating the family.
This police officer, maybe he was a rookie, he got in, he wasn't really the right kind of guy to be a cop.
I would suggest to you this. If that's the case, then what we're seeing is a pattern in practice of the failures of the screening process. We've seen patterns and practices that have been born out of the failures of the screening process, the psychological screening process, the training, the testing, the screening of individuals that want to become police officers is not adequate and it's not sufficient enough to safeguard against these kinds of attitudes and mentalities and these kinds of preconceptions that would allow an officer to engage in this kind of activity using racial epithets. We're not screening for racial sensitivities and cultural competency. We're not screening for aptitudes for violence and some of these other critical psychological data points that are being missed in the screening process. This is not just this one officer that has been caught engaging in criminal activity that was racially based or racially biased. We're seeing videos emerge all across social media of NYPD officers, both physically identifiable and some not, who are using racial biases in their policing. They're using racial biases in their patrolling, in their investigating, in their engaging on a regular basis, just everyday New Yorkers. So this is not just this case of a bad apple. This is a case of a culture which both enables and then protects bad apples. And look, if you only had 1% of all of the NYPD as bad apples, just 1%, you're talking about literally hundreds of officers who are bad apples. I don't think that's an acceptable state of reality for our police.
Reverend Kirsten Foy of Arc of Justice, and that was Officer Michael Reynolds, who resigned earlier today from the NYPD. And that's some of the news for Thursday, January 2nd, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Ken Gale. From the studios of the locally produced, listener-sponsored, and independent WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.